Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome to today's episode, where we will discuss the pressing policy issues shaping firearm-related harm both in Washington State and across the nation. Today, we're joined by two leading experts in the field, Ali Rohani Rabar and Fred Rivara, as they share their insights, experiences, and hopes for the future of effective policy intervention to mitigate firearm violence. My name is Cami Rankin, and I'm a fourth-year PhD candidate in epidemiology at the University of Washington School of Public Health, and I'm also the co-lead of the policy team at the Firearm Injury and Policy Research Program, along with Dr. Alice Ellison.
It's great to be here with you today and with these experts in the field. My name's Alice Ellison. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Washington and a faculty investigator in the Firearm Injury and Policy Research Program.
Thank you for having us. I'm Ali Rohani Rabar. As you mentioned, I am the director of the Firearm Injury and Policy Research Program at the University of Washington School of Medicine and the professor of epidemiology at the School of Public Health.
Hi, I'm Fred Rivara. I'm professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine and adjunct professor of epidemiology in the School of Public Health.
Thank you both so much for being here today. We're excited to hear from you. I want to start with the first question by asking you, what are the key policy issues influencing firearm-related harm in Washington, and are those the same facing us nationally?
Washington State has been very active in the past several years in terms of enacting different policies related to firearms and firearm-related harm. As you know, we are one of 21 states and the District of Columbia who have had ERPO or extremist protection order policies. We also have strengthened our domestic violence protection order related firearm prohibitions in Washington State. There have been several initiatives, including Initiative 1639 in Washington State that enhanced background checks and waiting period requirements for the purchase or transfer of semi-automatic assault rifles, required training to purchase a semi-automatic assault rifle, and developed some criminal liability for failure to safely secure a firearm under certain conditions, and added safety warning and safe storage requirements for dealers and a lot of other components. And so in light of some of these developments in Washington State, we have a landscape essentially that is really, really ready for a lot of evaluation to really understand how these policies are affecting the lives of people in Washington and by what mechanisms they are doing so.
I think nationally, there are some large issues that we're all trying to contend with. The Supreme Court, as we all know, with the Bruin decision, has really made it very difficult to think about firearm-related legislation, and will the laws that we currently have be able to continue to stand on the books or not? And the Supreme Court did uphold that individuals convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors or felonies cannot have guns, and guns can be taken away from them, which we all was worried about. But I think another thing that I'm concerned about nationally is the fact that we do have laws. We do have states like California, Washington, Connecticut, Massachusetts, which do have fairly restrictive firearm laws. However, they are surrounded by states that don't have such restrictive laws. And I think this—we all know—we have porous borders in this country, and the ability to buy firearms and bring them to another state is, I think, a constant threat to individuals. Each state in our country. So although an individual state will have laws and successfully reduce firearm-related harm in those states, there's always the risk of firearms coming from one state to another.
Next, we would like to ask you if you can please share if you have a hot take in the field of firearm policy research.
One of the most important things for us to consider as we do policy evaluation is to really think about the mechanisms by which policies may impact people's lives. There is research on several different policies now that has produced effect estimates about and quantified about, you know, the impact of these policies and how they affect people's lives is something that it needs more research and more evaluation and exploration. I think in policy evaluations, whether it is gun policy evaluation, social policy evaluation, we sometimes jump into conclusions about whether particular policies have any effect or they don't have any effect. I think it's really important to sometimes take a step back and think about the mechanisms by which they may exert their effect. Even if policies do not show any empiric evidence that they work or they change mortality or injury or any other types of firearm-related harm, even if they don't show any impact, I think it still is really important to think about the mechanisms by which they were supposed to work and why in this case, for example, they didn't work or what those steps along the way were that were supposed to be working, but they didn't. And so that's really important. If the policy is shown to have an impact on those final ultimate outcomes, it's still very valuable to know what the mechanisms were, because that really provides some insight and evidence about maybe things that need to be changed or things that really need to be focused on and pathways that we need to invest on. So my bottom line is that we need to better understand some of these mechanistic pathways by which policies may have an impact, and that is right now much needed for the field as a whole.
Thanks for sharing that thought, Ali. I think hearing you talk about the research and how important it is that we identify the mechanisms by which we expect things to reduce firearm-related harm, I'm curious to hear you describe a specific instance, Fred, where you witnessed research effectively influencing or shaping policy and how that was achieved.
Well, I think that one of the most important pieces of research in the last decade has been the simple research letter done by Justin Goldstick, Rebecca Cunningham, and Pat Carter from the University of Michigan, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which showed that for youth between 1 and 19 years of age, more children and adolescents are dying from firearms than dying from motor vehicles. And that has been enormously important. Whenever you now hear about anybody, the president, the surgeon general, the Supreme Court, talk about firearms and firearm violence, inevitably that one fact will be quoted. So it was really a very simple research letter, but it had enormous importance in terms of helping to put in this very simple terms to the public the importance of the firearm problem.
So thank you for highlighting that, Fred. So related to that, research projects that were done in the past decade or so focused on secure storage of firearms were really instrumental and influential in some of the policies that then were ensued. So for example, the type of work that was done on the importance of secure storage of firearms as a prevention strategy for suicide prevention among youth and also accidental shootings of children. That research was influential for an ordinance at the city level that was in place in Seattle back in 2018. And then at the state level in the state of Washington, also as part of 1639, the requirements for secure storage. So that's a kind of translation, if you will, from research to policy that we have seen. Sometimes those don't happen, you know, very rapidly. It takes years and years and decades for policies to be designed and devised after a large body of literature has been accumulated. Here in this case, we have seen this translation a little bit more rapidly, how really clear evidence about the strong association between secure storage and reductions in suicide and unintentional shootings of children and adolescents really has resulted in some of these policies. Now, of course, we need to evaluate these policies, but the point is that the policies were clearly informed by a robust body of research, and that has been one of the really shining examples I can highlight.
Thank you both for all of your insights and time today. We would like to end by asking both of you, beginning with Fred, to share with us what gives you hope for progress in reducing firearm-related harm through policy.
It's been the Alliance for Gun Responsibility. They have made an enormous difference. Before they came around in 2014, the state of Washington was graded down as probably a D level in terms of our firearm legislation. But now we're clearly a B plus to an A in terms of our firearm legislation. And it's really due to the efforts of the folks at the Alliance for Gun Responsibility. There are individuals there that suffered firearm deaths in their families, and they have turned that grief into really trying to help all of us understand how these kinds of policies can make an enormous difference in making us all safer.
Yeah, thank you for that, Fred. And I would say at the national level also, both in Washington, but also at the national level, I am really hopeful about the involvement of young people and the new generation. In this space, there are more and more now, increasing number of young people who are involved, who are engaged in this, who are committed to making a change and saving lives. They all are involved in different ways, and they may have different priorities or particularly be passionate about a particular policy, but the reality is that they are really, really involved and they can make a big difference. For the advocacy that they do, for the connection also that they have with scientists and people who generate evidence, and also very much the involvement of communities in this. I think in recent years, especially, we have seen further investments at the federal level and state level on approaches such as community violence intervention or CVI that really has been taken to a new level in terms of working with communities and community-centered approaches to change lives. Policies that may have implications in terms of, for example, compensating individuals who are engaged in this, or use of Medicaid for healthcare providers who are engaged in, for example, community violence intervention and reimbursement of those, or those who do lethal means counseling. Some of these developments in recent years have been really, really fortunate and potentially could be really, really consequential for the future and moving forward.
Thank you so much for being willing to share these insights with us today. As Cami and I were talking about getting to do this interview, we feel lucky to get to hear your input and insights all the time on, Ali, like you said, the very specific areas of research that we work in. We feel lucky that, you know, we can reach out to you and hear about the broader thoughts on Washington State and the nation. And so we're excited to get the chance to share those insights with other people.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.